make sure to give my dad a 5-star review.
Make sure to like and subscribe to his YouTube. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the show.
So what we've seen is that anytime I encounter a skeptic, it comes down to two faith-based beliefs, but the faith-based belief on the atheistic side and on the evolutionary side believes in supernatural principles that are basically pseudoscience. They're pushing science aside.
Hey, welcome back, Faithful Politics listeners and viewers. If you're watching us on our YouTube channel, I am your political host, Will Wright, and I'm joined by my friend, Padre, I don't know, like conservative pastor, Josh Bertram. How's it going, Josh?
All the above. Doing well. Thanks, Will.
And today we're thrilled to welcome David. Is it David Reeves?
Reeves is the last name.
Yeah. Reeves. Welcome David Reeves to our show. He's a dynamic speaker, author, and host of Creation in the 21st Century on TBN, where he explores the intersection of science, faith, and the Bible. He also has a passion for astronomy and the natural world. David advocates for a young earth creationist viewpoint, challenging mainstream scientific perspectives with this unique blend of biblical interpretation and observational science. Beyond his television hosting duties, he's also an accomplished author, having penned several books that delve into the reasons behind his beliefs. And I just learned shortly before this that you are also like a top 40s musician.
So, I live in Nashville. What do you expect?
That's true.
There you go, man. Yes.
Well, welcome to the show, David. We're really, really glad to have you.
Thank you. It's so great to be on.
So I guess, you know, we're going to be talking a lot about creationism on this episode. So I, you know, for our listeners who might not be familiar with their work or creation science in general, can you maybe just unpack what is creation science and how you became, you know, how you came to specialize in this field?
Well, I guess maybe I give you just a little bit of a backstory. When I was 16 years old, I had a passion for astronomy. And, you know, I remember seeing the comet Hale-Bopp. I was fascinated by that as a child. Then at 16, I began to connect cameras to the back of telescopes to see if I could get some astrophotography. And it's an art. It's an amazing, beautiful art that takes a lot of time, sleepless nights, blurry picture after blurry picture, and finally, once you get to one of those crystal clear nights and all of the stars align, pardon the pun, you get this amazing photograph. And I remember the first photograph that basically my jaw hit the floor was the Great Orion Nebula. And the Great Orion Nebula is a nebula. It's a cloud of dusts and gases in space. And I was blown away with the beauty, the complexity, and apparently the design of it. It looked just absolutely beautiful, but it looked designed. And I had been a Christian since an early age, but I began to really explore astrophysics, astronomy, cosmology, cosmogony, and some other fields related to that, just as a layman. And as I researched all of these different issues, again, I had all of these design components that kept popping up. Our position in the solar system, our position in the universe, et cetera, so forth and so on. And I was like, wow, this is more than just a hobby for me. This is actually something that I could use my passion for astrophotography to then couple with the discussion about design and ultimately who that designer is, which I believe is the God of the Bible.
That's great. I really appreciate that. And of course, we both would share that sentiment with you of believing in a God that created this world. And I just think it's awesome that you've turned your passion into something that you can use to help people see more about this creation and more about what God has done. You know, I know about the Wonder Center and the Science Museum. Could you talk a little bit about those things and how and your work there?
Absolutely. So when I was 18 years old, I formed a nonprofit, a 501c3, and I began sharing those photos to everyone who would listen. I would go to these small churches. I would go to these little conferences. And I've lived in Middle Tennessee most of my life. Then all of a sudden, I started to get invitations out of state, and then invitations out of country, and then invitations to host and narrate documentaries and TV shows on this origins topic. Where did we come from? What does design imply? Does it imply a designer? And eventually, I started to collect artifacts. I would collect meteorites from Campo del Cielo in Argentina. I would collect fossils, whether it be crinoids or bivalves or fossilized corals or dinosaur bones, all of these types of things that some of them I would go out in the field and I would research and collect myself. Some of them were given to me. Some of them I was able to find in other areas. And eventually, it sort of became this dream. In fact, it's been a dream since about 9 years old that one day I would have a place to display all of these rocks and fossils that I love to collect. So I remember vividly at 8 or 9 collecting fossils from my backyard. And I would stick them in the back of, stick them in a fishing tackle box, basically. And the more fossils that I collected from Middle Tennessee, the more fossils I realized, well, almost all of these are marine fossils. They're aquatic sea fossils, whether it's crinoids, which are sea animals that live in the deep ocean, or, you know, fossilized corals or bivalves and seashells. And so it struck me, because I'd always read the biblical accounts and believed that these were literal historical events, it struck me that I could actually use these fossils to point back to the Bible. So the more I collected, I filled up this fishing tackle box. And at about 9 years old, I said, you know what? I need a bigger box. So I'm looking around and, oh, here's a big tough box that goes in the back of a pickup truck. This'll do perfectly. So I start to fill up fishing tackle boxes in this big tough box. And at one point, I printed out a little black and white sign on a printer that said Reeves Fossil Museum. And I scotch taped it to the front of this box. And I was like, anybody that would show up at my house anywhere, I would drag them over to this box and I would be, look, you have to look at these fossils. And you also have to look at how these fossils are pointing to a catastrophic flood event, just as recorded in the Bible. And again, at an early age, this was something that I had an interest in, but I never knew that it would actually turn into what it has today, because now we fast forward a number of years later, and indeed, we have a much larger box still. Not a big, tough box that goes in the back of a pickup, but we just opened the largest science museum in Tennessee, over 100,000 square feet. It is by far the largest science museum in the world from a Christian perspective. And we have whole exhibit halls dedicated to paleontology, to astronomy, to biology, to zoology, to all of these different scientific fields. Yet we're not ashamed to point back to the design features within those scientific fields that we believe is pointing back to the grand designer, the engineer of it all.
That's really cool, and I envy your passion and sort yes. of turning it into, you know, something that you can share with the world. I guess my so I'm going to give you just a little bit of a backstory. So I didn't grow up Christian. I came to the faith very, very late in life, 2008. My wife was the one that actually brought me to the faith. She was a pastor's kid. And it was very reminiscent of, like, you know, you see a girl you like, so you start going to Bible study with her kind of thing. So, like, that was essentially, I mean, totally. If there was a Reader's Digest version of, like, how I became a Christian, that basically was it. And, you know, growing up in Southern California, like I said, I spent most of my life as an atheist, non-believer. And one of the biggest hangups I had to coming to the faith was the, you know, the disparity between what I thought I knew about science and all kinds of stuff, and then what the majority of Christians that I knew thought about science and evolution and everything. And I'll just be upfront, like, I still believe in evolution, like, because it makes sense to me, and I can appreciate and see God's beauty in the world. And like, I do think the world is beautiful and space is beautiful. And I think that God created it all. How he did it, I have no idea. But talk to us a little bit about, about creationism and some of the debates that are surrounding sort of this topic, specifically like how old the earth is, you know, if dinosaurs existed and so on and so forth.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey there, Josh Bertram here, faithful host of the Faithful Politics Podcast. I want to let you know about a compelling new spinoff, the Faith Roundtable, where I'll be interviewing top faith leaders, theologians, and scholars to unpack the pressing issues that are shaping the church in America today. We'll dive into topics like faith in public life, social justice, and how we can engage our communities more effectively. Make sure you don't miss any of our enlightening conversations by subscribing to it on our YouTube channel. Join me at the Faith Roundtable, where deep discussion meets thoughtful insight.
Well, most of the top scientists of all times had faith in a creator of some sorts. We find that all the way throughout the pinnacles of science, whether it was Sir Isaac Newton came along and he's pioneering all of these scientific concepts, whether it's Francis Bacon or James Clerk Maxwell or Galileo, who said that mathematics is the language with which God has written the universe, all the way up until about the time of Dr. Wernher von Braun, when we first went to the moon. And Dr. Wernher von Braun was basically sending men to the moon. He is pretty much leading NASA before NASA was an official institution. And he's leading a government program for the U.S. government. He said a lot of people look at science and religion as antagonists. He said they're not. They're sisters. While science tries to better understand creation, the world around us, religion tries to better understand the creator. But you see, he understood this conundrum, and he said, you can't really have creation without a creator. You can't have design without a designer. One implies the other. Over the last maybe two, three generations, there has been this extreme rise in atheistic belief. But a lot of it is due to peer pressure within the academic community. And what we've found is that many, even intellectual atheists, are coming to see that there are design components. And that is exciting to me, because the more scientific discoveries are revealing, the more they're actually pointing back to a creator. Which then brings us to your other question, and that was, well, what about creationism in general? What about the age of the earth? Well, I believe that the universe is about 6,000 years old. I believe that based on biblical chronology as well as scientific studies. And most of my colleagues would agree. I mean, I have probably 100 PhDs on speed dial that I talk to on a regular basis who concur with this general belief in approximately a 6,000 to 10,000 year old universe and a created universe at that. Well, at this point, we get into debates on, well, evolution versus creation. What is creation and what is evolution? And whenever someone asks me, well, see, you're one of these people that just despises evolution. And to that, I do not reply, that's right. I say, what do you mean by evolution? Because if you're going to tell me, oh, well, I mean that species can adapt over time, I'm going to say, well, if that's what you think evolution is, then yes, I believe in evolution, right? If you tell me that we're talking about mutations, which add up over time, if that's how you define evolution, then I would believe in evolution. But again, that's not classical universal common descent. You see, we have to define terms here. And whereas there are changes that do occur in biological forms, if you want to call that evolution, that's fine. There are changes that occur all the time. They're observable, they're repeatable, they're demonstrable, they're empirical, but they're not classical Darwinian evolution. See, Darwin proposed in something that we call universal common descent, and that's what that everything in the universe commonly descended from a single-cell amoeba, which ultimately that happened by turning non-life into life. And that's something that we've never actually observed. It's something that can't be scientifically proven. And also, it's something that breaks laws of science. In other words, there are laws of science that have never been broken before in all of observational science that state that life only begets life, that you can't get life from non-living forms. Rocks don't turn into frogs, basically. So basically, universal common descent has to have an exception to this rule, to this scientific law, at least one time. And that means that at some time in the distant past, millions upon millions of years ago, non-living things like soup, rocks, water, whatever you want to call it, had to have turned into living creatures, the first single-celled organism, which then turned to fish, frog, ape, mankind, et cetera, et cetera. That's actually a pseudoscience because there are no scientific evidences where we've ever observed this happening. And I believe that the design perspective has a lot more physical evidence in the scientific world, as well as a lot more historical evidence from a book that has stood the test of time. We call it the Holy Bible, but it really has stood the test of time historically, scientifically, prophetically, and when it comes to the gospel message.
That's a really good explanation, and one I haven't really heard before. So I appreciate you you saying that. But like, how do creationists account for, like, you know, the light from like distant stars, you know, which suggests that the universe is like billions of years old?
That's a great question. Okay, so what we're talking about is called the distant starlight problem, and the distant starlight problem goes something like this. If the universe is only 6,000 years old, and I personally have taken a photograph of a galaxy millions of light years away. I've personally taken that with our ministry telescopes, with our cameras and equipment. So how does the light from a galaxy millions of light years away get to the Earth in only 6,000 years? Couple of key points that we need to address early on, and that is that a light year is not a measurement of time. A light year is the measurement of distance. It's the distance that light would travel, supposedly at 12 million miles a minute, after an entire year. So it's actually a distance, not a time. And then the second thing that we need to address pretty early on is that most atheistic astronomers, most skeptics who believe in a Big Bang, believe in 14 billion years of stellar evolution, they also have a starlight and time problem, and it's called the horizon problem. And any PhD astrophysicist will clearly tell you instantly, they will admit, they'll say, David, even given 14 billion years, that's not enough time for light to reach point A to point B across the universe. And you say, well, what do you mean by that? And they're like, this is what we call the horizon problem. We have a starlight and time problem, even given 14 billion years. But we've fixed this problem with something called inflation. And inflation is the idea that a few picoseconds after the Big Bang, 14 billion years ago, the universe as a whole and all the matter in the universe started expanding faster than the speed of light. And then, at some point, it magically slowed down to its current linear expansion rate. All right, so wait a second. What you're telling me is that you believe in a supernatural principle that magically sped up matter faster than the speed of light and then magically slowed it down to its current rate. Well, yes, that's what we're telling you. Well, what is your mechanism? We have no mechanism. So in other words, it is a supernatural mechanism, a faith-based belief to fix the secular astronomers' starlight and time problem. All right, so that's where we base this discussion off of. So if 14 billion years isn't sufficient time for light to reach from point A to point B, then I'll admit that Christians also have a major starlight and time problem to try to get that light in 6,000 years. However, I'm also going to tell you that we have solutions. I actually have a friend who has a PhD in physics by the name of Dr. Russell Humphreys. And he has noted that Einstein's theories of relativity require gravity to affect time. So let me see if I can put it this way. In other words, if we are somewhere in the middle of a gravitational well, which we should be if we're anywhere in the center of our galaxy, not in the dead center, but anywhere near the center of our galaxy and of the universe, then we would be in this gravitational well, which means that while 6,000 years might have passed on Earth, according to Einstein, according to his theories of relativity, which have been proven, the further out in space you go, the more time has elapsed. So more than 6,000 years may have elapsed out in the far distant reaches of the universe, allowing that starlight to reach us in only 6,000 Earth years. Now, we've been able to measure atomic clocks at sea level. We've been able to measure atomic clocks in Denver, Colorado. We've been able to measure the atomic clocks on the International Space Station, the ISS, and they all run at different rates based on that gravitational pull. So Einstein's theories of relativity are robust, and they tell us that gravity is affecting time. So I think that a robust, proven scientific principle, Einstein's theories of relativity, showing that gravity affects time, may be one of the solutions to the starlight and time problem. Now, I have another friend who has his PhD in astronomy. He wrote the foreword to my first book, Wonders Without Number, and he suggests that maybe gravitational time dilation isn't quite enough to account for millions of light years distance, right? And to that, his name is Dr. Danny Faulkner, again, PhD in astronomy, and he notes that there are multiple words used within the creation account in Genesis, and one of those words is the Hebrew word dasha, which means to spring forth or bring forth. It's used, for instance, when God said, let the earth bring forth green things, let the earth bring forth animals. So it's, if you can almost imagine within the course of minutes or hours or certainly within the time frame of a day, the earth brought forth from a little seed a mighty sequoia tree, okay? It's a rapid maturing. So why couldn't God have used this exact same rapid maturing process when it comes to the creation of the universe, where he places galaxies on the fabric of space-time and then rapidly stretches it out, therefore allowing that starlight to always be here? And if that's not enough, I've got one more to shoot out at you, and this one hopefully doesn't take too
long.
Please
do.
Yeah.
This one is based on a friend who has his PhD in astrophysics from the University of Boulder, Colorado, and his name is Dr. Jason Lyle, and he states that there is no way for us to measure the one-way speed of light. According to Einstein's theories of relativity, you cannot actually determine the exact speed of light one way. You can measure it two ways and then divide by two. But what if light functions differently in the far distant regions of space and is traveling at a different rate? There's no way to prove that. It's a convention. It's not even a theory. Nevertheless, what I'm telling you is that we have three robust models that can potentially solve the starlight and time problem. And the best model for evolutionary astronomy, the best model for Big Bang astronomy, is actually a supernatural origins model that says that all of a sudden, everything in the universe expanded faster than the speed of light, and then all of a sudden, it slowed down with no mechanism why. What I'm telling you is, yeah, we have a problem, but secular astronomy has a problem as well. And I think that the creator can solve that problem. I think there's a real solution out there.
That's really cool. So, and mind you, I'm like ill-equipped to really even ask some of these questions. So like, what about like carbon dating? You know, I mean, like what, from what I remember from like my chemistry, physics, whatever class back in college, you know, that like we can sort of tell how old things are, you know, through their half-lives and whatnot. So, and there are things on the planet that I believe have, you know, been carbon dated millions of years ago. So how does that work?
Yeah, excellent question. Carbon dating is actually the young Earth creationist, one of his best friends, because carbon dating cannot be used beyond about 80,000 years. So it caps it at thousands of years. C14 would completely decay. It has a measured decay rate. And if it maintains its decay rate that we observe today, then it would completely decay away, unmeasurable, within 80 to 100,000 years. And yet, we have found C14 still present in dinosaur bones that are supposedly 66 plus million years. That's what they were supposed. And yet, C14 present in them means that these dinosaurs must have died less than 80,000 years ago, much less. We have found measurable amounts of C14 in other things like worms and other biological creatures that are supposed to be approximately 500 million years old. Yet, C14 means that they are less than 80,000 years old. And then get this. We have also been able to test diamonds, and it's not an anomaly. People said, well, maybe it's contamination in our, you know, accelerated mass spectrometers. But they would try in other machines, and they would clean the samples, and they would do everything they can. We found measurable amounts of C14 in diamonds, which are supposedly 2 to 3 billion years old. But C14 caps the age of the diamonds at less than 80,000 years. In other words, C14 has proven that the majority of the Earth and the universe is less than millions of years old. It's actually only thousands of years old. To this, an erudite skeptic would say, well, David, what about other forms of radiometric dating like potassium argon, rubinium strontium, lead? To which, absolutely, some of those methods, if you calculate their current decay rate, would supposedly get you out into the millions of years. However, most of the methods are fraught with assumptions, and most of those assumptions are based on the idea that the decay rates have remained constant. Well, you can ask any nuclear physicist, and they'll tell you that climate change changes the decay rate of radioactive particles. So, in other words, for us to believe in the supposed millions of years, we have to deny that the climate has ever changed within history. And I think that that would be a massive denial of, I mean, you know, you can argue the whole idea, well, is mankind actually causing this climate change, or is it nature? You could argue that all day long, but I don't think anybody's going to argue that the climate has changed over time, and therefore the decay rates of these radioactive particles have changed, meaning you can't trust the millions of years from those other radioactive dating methods.
It's so fascinating. You know, I love going back to assumptions, right? Because all of us make assumptions and we operate off of assumptions. And I always ask like the questions, and that's why this conversation is so fascinating to me, because I always go like, well, how do we actually know that? Like a scientist can tell me that. And I, you know, we're supposed to trust scientists, or we're, you know, kind of told, you know, we're not the experts or whatever, but how do you, but they figured it out some way, right? Instead, unless they just made it up, which no one's going to say that's a good method. And it's always the method is where is, you know, the devil's in the details of the method. And, you know, it's so like for me, I've never been one that's been convinced by evolution. And that's not because I'm some skeptic, I mean, some expert in it or anything like that. It just felt like some of the things you said, like, well, how does something non-living turn into something living? I haven't really heard anything that's really convinced me that that leap is possible without some kind of divine intervention at some level. How does something, you know, how do we get from a single cell into the complex beings that we are, even like that itself? I've never heard a convincing. Now, that doesn't mean there isn't one. That doesn't mean that I haven't. I just haven't seen it. I haven't read it yet. And I'm totally open to that. But my question, well, I love the conversation. Go ahead. You can respond to that. Go ahead.
Well, no. I was just going to mention that those different theories are, although they're believed by a large portion of scientists, those theories are just fraught with these assumptions. And if you question the scientists who believe in these theories, they have to admit ultimately that they believe them by faith, because we've never been able to test these theories scientifically. And I'll just also throw one more thing out there, and that was one clarification. You mentioned that, you know, all of these scientists, like that, surely it must be real. Let me put it this way. Science is real, but scientists can lie to you, right? Science will never lie to you. It's the raw data. It's what we all study. But then scientists can interpret that data in multiple different ways. And some scientists have chosen to interpret it in one way, and some scientists have chosen to interpret it in the other. Ultimately, you have to ask yourself, well, where's the preponderance of the evidence? Where are the actual scientific principles that can cause this? And evolution has some major problems with faith-based gaps that you have to put patchwork over.
Yeah, absolutely. And I definitely agree with that. And of course, like as a Christian, my biggest issue with evolution has been, again, like you say, it's everything's in the definition of it, of what you mean by that change over time. But that's not normally what people are talking about when they say evolution. And one of my biggest issues has always kind of been like, well, one of the issues as a Christian is so much of it is this assumption of this, of like this methodological naturalism, which essentially you have to take any kind of outside force or whatever from God and exclude that, like on its face. And so any explanation you're going to come up with, if you have that principle, right, or that assumption is automatically going to exclude God from that, because you can't include God if your method doesn't allow, if it's naturalism, that only what exists is naturalism, you know. But what I'd love to get your thoughts on, I have so many questions, but one that I'd love to get your thoughts on is what do you imagine, what have you heard from, you know, people when you've given this explanation of like carbon dating, again, going to 60,000 years, 80,000 years, or these other aspects of dating? What kind of pushback, what are their arguments against like you, and how have you responded to those? Like, say, cause I'm not an expert. Will isn't an expert, right? We don't have PhDs in these areas, but what might a PhD say, you know, to you, or what have they said, and how have you guys responded there, in your organization and you personally?
To the C14 assumptions, no response. They've never been able, no one I've talked to who has a PhD has ever been able to give me an actual response. They just say, well, you know, that's what the current assumptions show, so we've just got to trust the current assumptions, right? So it's a trust, it's a faith, right? When it comes to the starlight and time issue, absolutely no response. Because again, every astrophysicist, every cosmologist knows that even they have a starlight and time problem that they've fixed with a supernatural theory. When it comes to geology, I'll give you one example. I was, at Lee's Ferry, which is the starting point of the rafting trips down the Colorado River, down through the Grand Canyon. And I had been doing some on-location documentary work, videography there. I just got off camera. We turned the cameras off, and down in the distance, I saw a lady loading up a raft. And so I walked over there, just started a conversation with her, and I said, what are you doing there? And she said, oh, I'm loading up this raft. We're getting ready to leave tomorrow morning on a 16-day journey down the Colorado River all the way through the Grand Canyon.
Wow.
And, you know, and I was like, whoa, I applaud you. I don't think that I could handle 16 days, but I applaud you. She said, what are you doing? And, you know, I thought for a second, and I was like, well, this could be interesting. I said, well, I'm actually shooting on-location footage at how this canyon may have been formed very rapidly with a lot of water over a short period of time, as a result of massive flooding, catastrophic flooding. And she said, oh. And she turns around and starts loading the raft again. But I see this tall, lanky fellow comes in my peripheral vision, comes storming up. He'd been behind a Jeep listening to our conversation. And he runs up to me and he said, did I hear you say that you think this canyon formed over a short period of time with a lot of water? And I was like, I believe that there's a lot of data to indicate that, yes. And he said, my PhD is in geology. All right, so here we go. He said, and I'm here to tell you that this canyon formed over about 6 million years of evolution as the Colorado River that you see right here carved it slowly over millions and millions of years. And I said, well, I understand that you believe that, but is it okay if I just ask you a few questions? Now, I'm a layman. I don't know anything about geology past what my colleagues have taught me over the years and past what my studies have taught me. I'm not a PhD in geology by any means. But I'm like, well, let's just have a civil dialogue here. So could I ask you a few questions? He said, oh, certainly. You can ask me anything you want. I said, well, have we ever seen a canyon form like this right here over 6 million years of slow gradual evolution from a river like this right here? And he said, well, no, of course we haven't seen. We as a species haven't even been around on Earth long enough to observe such a canyon forming. And I said, but you still believe that it took 6 million years for this river to form it, right? And he said, well, of course I believe that. I said, is it okay if I ask you another question? He said, certainly, anything. I said, is there any test? Are there any simulations in a lab? Is there anything we can do to try to simulate a canyon like this, this massive Grand Canyon forming from a river like this over 6 million years, and it still forms these same features with these straight up and down walls, all of this? And he's like, well, no, there's no simulation, no laboratory test that we can do. And I said, but you still believe that, don't you? And he said, well, of course I believe that. And I said, well, you believe it by faith. And he said, well, of course. And he thought for a second, and he couldn't respond. A PhD in geology realized in that moment, after two questions, that he believes in a faith-based principle that can't be seen, observed. It's not empirical. It's not empirical. It's not demonstrable. There's no way we can test it in a lab. In other words, he believes by faith in something that is not able to be proven scientifically, simply because his professor taught him that, and his professor before him taught him that. So in other words, when I've had dialogues with skeptics, even atheists, this has always been the case, in that it comes down to there are two faith-based beliefs, and my faith-based belief is not a blind faith. There's actual evidence and historical evidence to suggest that we have a universe that is designed with purpose. You know, Charles Darwin, in his seminal work on the Origin of Species, the full title is on the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection or the Preservation of Favored Races. And Charles Darwin was ultimately a hardcore racist who believed that certain people were much closer to animals than other people like himself. So the title of his book indicated that, but the title of his book was focused on natural selection. Well, Charles Darwin's living in the 1800s. He has primitive technology. Yes, he's seeing things with his eyes, and then he's interpreting those things, but he's not using the scientific tools that we have today. He's looking at a cell, and he thinks it's a bag of enzymes instead of as complex as a city, as a metropolis that we know that one single cell is today. Charles Darwin is looking at nature as his guide. Well, natural selection implies that nature has a mind and is able to select. Mother Nature can accomplish anything given enough time. What have you just done? You've deified nature. You've turned nature into a god in an attempt to deny what I believe is the one true God, the God of the Bible. And so what we've seen is that anytime I encounter a skeptic, it comes down to two faith-based beliefs. But the faith-based belief on the atheistic side and on the evolutionary side believes in supernatural principles that are basically pseudoscience. They're pushing science aside.
You know, I think when it comes to like creationist ideology, I do get a little bit nervous because like there have been like misuses of sort of this ideology throughout history. So like one in particular is like polygenesis, this idea that black people came from one line in the creation story, and you know, folks that look like me are sort of forever damned to be slaves and whatnot, you know. So I'd love to get your thoughts about like how do creationist perspectives, ideology, like adapt to like new scientific discoveries that might contradict, you know, what their current interpretations are?
Yeah, absolutely. See, as a Christian, I believe that everyone is a sinful, a fallible human being, and we can all make mistakes. So throughout every period of history. You go back to the Crusades, and in the name of Christ, many evil things were done, right? You go back to some of the theologies that you were mentioning, and they basically took cherry-picking verses from the Bible and twisting them into these racist ideologies or into these other ideologies that have no real basis on the historical context of the Bible. And so absolutely, these things have been abused by people for years and years, but if you take the whole of Scripture, including the context around it, it's clear that there's only one blood, that we're all related to Adam, that we're all one race, and therefore we're all created in God's image. So therefore we're all equal. Are we all sinners? Absolutely. Are we all in need of a Savior? Absolutely. But there is no one less than anyone else. However, now I'm going to pivot and I'm going to say that based on the Bible, we actually see that animals are under humans. You see, today we're taught that we're nothing more than highly evolved animals, that we're the formation of ape-like creatures that evolved into mankind. And that puts us on the same level as animals. That's the evolutionary ideology. Whereas in the Bible, it is 100% clear that the animals were created first, not in God's image. Then we were created in His image, fearfully and wonderfully made is what the book of Psalms. And then we were put in dominion over the animal kingdom. Now, when I say dominion, I'm not talking about we abuse creation, we abuse nature, we abuse animals, we abuse the environment. In other words, we were given charge over it to nurture, protect, to try to use it for our own good. And I certainly do that when I have a hamburger. But what I'm telling you is that there are creatures that are below humans, and they're called animals. We are all equal in God's eyes and in each other's eyes. It's just been people's interpretations of various theologies that have corrupted this.
So that's so fascinating to me. And I think about that, like when I'm talking to my kids and, you know, they go to public school and they haven't had a lot of like evolutionary theory taught to them at this point. My oldest is in fourth grade, so it hasn't quite come to that yet. But I think about this idea that, like, yeah, there's constantly this push, like, hey, we're just animals, you know, and we're in this hominid whatever genus or family or whatever it is, we're Homo sapiens. I'm forgetting all the terminology, right? But in this hominid, line. And what do we like? And the Bible certainly elevates people above that. And I totally agree with that. What is like? How do we work through, how do you guys work through these, like that prevailing way of thinking? And especially like when it comes to things like, hey, look at these different species, Neanderthal, Heidelbergensis, I'm forgetting all the names, right? All these different skeletons they found. Is like, what is the kind of, like, how do we work through that for you guys there at the museum and your colleagues? What's the explanation there? I'm super curious to hear, like, because obviously, right, what you said, we're all dealing with the same data, right? We're dealing with the same bones, we're still dealing with the same fossils, whatever they are. How do you guys work through that? What's the interpretation there?
Yeah, we're dealing with the same data, but we're dealing with prideful scientists who want their discovery to be the best discovery that has ever been. Let me boil it down for you this way. In the Wonder Center and Science Museum, we're just 35 minutes west of Nashville, again, 100,000 square feet. So there's a nice section dedicated to anthropology. There's a nice section dedicated to human anatomy. We have a coffee shop. And when I formed the coffee shop, I called it Java Man, all right? Because we all know that we love our Java. But on the Isle of Java, Java Man was discovered. Java Man has been one of these supposed proofs of human, of ape-like origins for humans, right? It's been touted in textbooks. It's been taught to young people for years. It's just one of these things along the line. What is Java Man? Well, most of the time in the textbooks, our children are not told what he consists of. Yeah, he was found on the Isle of Java. He's proof that ape-like creatures turned into humans. What's your proof? What'd you find? Well, you see, we found a skull, a portion of a skull cap. It was a little piece of a skull cap. Okay, what else? Well, we found a femur bone. That's the leg bone, you know, the thigh bone, right? Okay, what else? Well, we found a tooth. Okay, all right, what else did you find? Well, those three things were scattered along a hillside, and that's all we found. And they developed an entire creature from those three things, a tooth, a little piece of a skull, and one leg bone, called Java Man, and it's supposedly proof that we somehow evolved from ape-like ancestors. So in our coffee shop, every cup of coffee has a sticker where you will learn the true story of Java Man, not the hype, because the scientist that found it, yeah, he wants it to be the best discovery ever. Hey, I finally found the missing link of human evolution, right? But in reality, it's just a few bones that don't prove a thing. If you go over into the anthropology section of the museum, into that exhibit hall, you're going to see the full skeleton of Lucy. A copy, obviously, not the actual bones, but the full skeleton of Lucy. Lucy was found by Donald Johanson in the 1970s or 80s and in Ethiopia. And it has long been, for over 40 years, touted as proof of human evolution. All right? Now, there were quite a few bones found, and they've been staring at these bones for 40 years, teaching them to children that this is an ape-like creature that was learning to walk upright. All right, well, let's look at Lucy for a second. They've been staring at her skeleton for over 40 years, and there's one neck bone, one tiny little bone right over here that they've been looking at, and they finally said to themselves, you know what, that looks weird. Well, turns out for almost 40 years, they'd misidentified it. It was from an entirely different creature, another type of an extinct bonobo, and it didn't even belong with the rest of the skeleton. All right, it took them 40 years to spot this. This is the bias of wanting your discovery to be the best, right? Then they're looking at it and they're like, well, we see that the pelvis, the hip bone, is fractured. And they took a grinder to the pelvis bone, and they glued it back together in a way that made it look like she might have walked upright. But in reality, it was fractured in a way that it looks like something stepped on her and broke her hip bone, and she didn't even walk upright. Then they noticed that all of the long bones of her body were also fractured, like her arm bones, her leg bones. There was no long bone that didn't have fracture marks, and they were green stick fractures. Now, what's a green stick fracture? That's what would happen if you were, say, 40 feet up in a tree, you fell out of the tree, you tried to brace yourself as you fell, and when you hit the ground, the impact, green stick fractured all of those long bones. Now, let me ask you a question. What is an upright walking human doing 40 feet up in a tree, number one? If I were to move on to a fifth point, it would be that her skull connects to the spinal column at an angle, and she had an angled face, all right? We as humans, we walk upright. We have a face that is straight up and down. But apes have an angled face, and that is because they're walking on all fours, and if they didn't have an angled face, they would have to crank their necks this way 24/7 to be able to see ahead of them, right? So it had an ape-like skull. And finally, now they're not even sure that Lucy is Lucy. They think that they may have misgendered it. It may be Brucey. After 40 years, they're looking at this creature, calling it a female, and it was actually a male.
Very 21st century of them.
It is. And the nail in the coffin is its scientific name, which is Australopithecus afarensis, which means southern ape. It is an ape. It's a 3.5 foot tall, 45-pound chimpanzee-like creature that fell 40 feet out of a tree, broke its hip bone, broke all of its other bones, and then scientist Donald Johanson finds it. He's like, I think I found the missing link. And he puts it back together in this remarkable way that makes it look almost human, yet it's nothing more than one extinct ape. So in other words, all of our hominid discoveries have either been apes our humans are perfect hoaxes. Like, there were others. Piltdown Man was a complete hoax. It was a pig's tooth glued into a human jaw. So every discovery, which haven't been many, by the way, that supposedly proves human evolution, we debunk those using real scientific principles, using anatomical principles that anybody can do, and we show that this is an ape, this is an ape, this is an ape, this is clearly a human, this is a human, these Neanderthals are clearly human. We have people living today with some of these same features in different ethnic groups, and you're trying to say that this is an ape-like creature or something that's less than human? No. Everything clearly falls, ape or human. There is no transitional species that has ever been found. What are the chances, if we as humans have been evolving from ape-like creatures over the past 300,000 years or more, as secular anthropologists will state, well, then there should be millions, more like billions, of skeletons of hominid creatures turning from ape to human that have lived and died over these. We should be finding them by the truckloads, and yet there are only about a dozen examples that supposedly prove human evolution, and all of those are clearly falling into human or ape. No transition whatsoever.
Yeah, so interesting. I guess, what would you say to someone, and I'm thinking kind of specifically about myself here, you know, that is struggling with creationism as the main reason that they couldn't become a Christian, you know, and maybe as a follow on, you know, do you believe that, you know, you have to believe in creationism to get to heaven?
Great questions. Absolutely not. It's very clear in the scriptures what it takes to be a Christian, what it takes to get to heaven. And belief in creationism is not one of those things. At the same time, here's what I found. We have been spoon-fed this narrative of naturalism, that nature has a mind, it's magical, it can produce everything without the need of God, for God, for so long that we've come to think of creationism, of belief in God's creation, as a stumbling block. And for many people, it is, including possibly yourself. But in reality, the new discovery, what we're talking about is using the old science, the antiquated science of Charles Darwin. If you move on into the 21st century, if you move on to the new discoveries in biology, paleontology, genetics, astronomy, archaeology, all of these things, those absolutely groundbreaking scientific discoveries that are happening now almost on a weekly basis are pointing towards creation, not evolutionary principles. And again, it's a hard thing for many of us who have heard the evolutionary story all of our lives. We've been taught it, but we have to understand that's old, that's antiquated. It's time that we look at new science and base our scientific principles on that, not based on what some scientist interpreted 100 years ago and wrote down in a book. Let's turn the corner here. And when we turn the corner, what we're finding is that everything is actually pointing not only to design, but also out of the approximately 100 dating methods, there are only 4 or 5 now that supposedly might show that the Earth is more than thousands of years old. And even those 4 and 5 are fraught with assumptions. So, in other words, all of these new discoveries are pointing not just to God's design, but ultimately to creation, and it appears to a much more recent creation than we've been spoon-fed this agenda of for years.
You know, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, has the James Webb Telescope, or maybe the better question is, how has the James Webb Telescope added to, you know, sort of the science? Because, I mean, personally, like I follow their Twitter feed or whatever, and I'm just in awe. Like every time they post a new picture, I'm like, oh, this is so cool. You know, like I wish I knew what I was looking at. but I'd love to get your thoughts about the James Webb Telescope.
Well, of course, being into astronomy, I was absolutely thrilled when it finally went up. And at the Wonder Center and Science Museum, we have a 60-foot full-dome planetarium with a 6-projector, 6.5K resolution setup out of over 4,000 planetariums on planet Earth. We rank in the top 10 based on technology, size, software, et cetera. So even NASA doesn't have some of the technology that we have at the Wonder Center. And what I've been doing is, as the new discoveries from the new photos come in from the James Webb Telescope come in, I've been downloading the ultra high res, the 8,000 by 8,000 pixels, and putting them full dome in the planetarium, which, when you're just surrounded in a fully interactive environment with these new photos that are coming out, it's awe-inspiring. But not only is it awe-inspiring, it's teaching us so much more. NASA's discoveries in science using astronomy we've discovered over 4,000 extrasolar planets so far. That's rocks orbiting other stars. So far, none of them have been confirmed to support life, which points to the idea that Earth is very unique. The other things that we've been seeing are areas of star activity where stars are going supernovae. And I've actually had the privilege of taking a photo of a star going supernova in the Whirlpool Galaxy several years ago. That was featured in my first book, I suppose. And all of these new discoveries that are coming out and the new photos with the James Webb, most of them in astronomy, we knew a lot of this shortly before. It's just now we've been able to visualize it in much greater detail. Some of this technology we've been able to see with the Hubble Space Telescope, but now the resolution is revealing, I mean, like a nebula is Latin for cloud. So it's a cloud of dusts and gases in space, right? And with the Webb technology, we're able to see the elemental structures of some of these nebulae in greater detail. And in my opinion, it leaves us in awe, and it points us back to, there's a verse in Psalm 19 that says that the heavens declare the glory of God, that the firmament shows his handiwork, that the expanse is showing God's handiwork, that day after day utters speech, that night unto night shows knowledge, but there's no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. So with the new discoveries by NASA, with the James Webb Telescope, with the new images that are coming out, it's clearly showing that the heavens are shouting out, that the cosmos is pointing to the fact that we have a grand designer, an engineer, that we're not cosmic accidents, star stuff, the result of billions of years of chance, but that we are made with purpose. And again, that points to something that is so relevant right now, and that is teen suicide is shooting through the roof. There are 22 veteran suicides every single day. We see school shootings, atrocities going on, and we have to ask ourselves, why? Why is this happening? Could it be that for the last 2-3 generations, we've been teaching people that they have no purpose in life, that they are simply accidents of the cosmos, star stuff, so therefore they're just animals? And what's the problem with one animal shooting, killing another animal? So what's the problem with the school shootings? What's my purpose? Where's my self-worth if I'm simply an accident? So therefore, why shouldn't I kill myself? These things are so relevant in today's society, and they all point back to the fact that if we could all accept that there appears to be a grand designer, and that's the God of the Bible, ultimately pointing to the gospel itself, that we have purpose through Christ, and that we live in a vast universe full of amazing things, but nothing can compare to the beauty of this planet, to the complexity of this planet, and ultimately to God's love for us when he created us in his image.
That's so good. I really appreciate those words. You know, I have so many questions, and maybe we'll have to jump on again and have like one that focuses more on some of the theological and biblical issues, because we didn't get to really talk about those as much as, and that's kind of supposed to be my job. So sorry, dude. I mean, honestly, what I really love about the conversation, I do have a last question before we kind of close out, but what I love about the conversation is that so often people just, they make so many assumptions, and just because the experts, just because it's popular, it's viewed, right? But as Christians, that can't be our default, whether that's just because it's popular in Christianity or in the wider world. Like, we should be truth seekers asking hard questions, not just settling for, oh yeah, that's what the experts say, but how do they come to those conclusions? And if they can't explain it to us, then that should bring some questions into our head. And I think with that, I did want to ask and give you a chance to respond to that, but I want to ask, what advice do you have for people listening to this, for Will and I? Like, yeah, I mean, we hear you. You have very convincing answers. You know them. You know your stuff, and it's obvious, right? But then, obviously, just trusting David Reeves, just because David Reeves said it, that's not what you want, I don't think. Or just like in the same way, you wouldn't want to just trust the scientists because the scientists said it. No, we have to look at the methods and look at the data. So what is your, like, what kind of advice do you have for us who are like, we just get bombarded with so many things? Well, if you don't believe in this, then you're just backward and all this stuff. What, how can we take a step back and look at things differently? What advice do you have for us?
So this is very heavy on my heart. Several years ago, we formed a 24/7 TV network called Genesis Science Network. And it has been airing for 7 years, free, on Roku, Fire TV, online, YouTube Live, 24/7, for 7 years, where there are nature documentaries, Animal Planet-style shows, there are PhD lectures, there are easy-to-understand apologetics principles. Airing 24/7 free, we've had salvation reports come in from people watching that television network. It's like a Christian version of the Discovery Channel. We don't spoon feed you the evolutionary perspectives. And we've seen, it's called Genesis Science Network, and it's 100% free. We have a magazine that we send out, print magazine, every other month, free of charge, called the Creation Club Magazine. And if somebody wants to learn more, there are science articles, kids' activities, and of course our ministry updates as well. And you can subscribe 100% free to that. We have so many resources, including this museum, that can be not only encouraging, but enlightening for those who might be a little bit skeptical or they're simply not knowing where to turn or who to believe. But ultimately, I'll point it right back to the New Testament, where Thomas said, you know what? How can I believe that Jesus rose from the dead unless I could actually touch the wounds through his hands? I just don't think I can do this. And what was Jesus' response? He said, Thomas, because you asked questions, because you doubted me, well, I guess that's it for you. Just go on your own. No, that's not what he said. He said, Thomas, you want evidence? Come here. Feel that. It's not bad to ask questions. As Christians, we all have faith, but it's not a blind faith. The evidence is all around us. And if we're willing to explore the evidence with an open mind, it is overwhelmingly pointing us right back to the creator of the universe.
I really appreciate that. And I really appreciate your words and for you coming on to the show. So besides the Genesis Science, can you say that network? Genesis Science Network, right?
Genesis
Science
Network.
How can people get involved? How can people check out your work? How can people look and test your claims, whatever it is they want to do? How can they do that?
Let's do it. DavidReeves.com. My name is David, RIVES.com. You can click on the magazine button on the menu and subscribe for free to the magazine and the email updates. We produce tons of video content, documentaries, short videos, 2-minute videos that we'll send out on emails on science, and then we relate that science to a Christian walk. So I would encourage you to do that. Again, we just opened in the Nashville area, but it is a massive science museum with a world-class planetarium, including, you know, every time I'm out in LA, I always stop at the Griffith Observatory, and I've always admired the Tesla coil that's behind glass at the Griffith Observatory. And I told myself, if I'm ever able to do this, I really want to have a Tesla coil on display. Well, I have friends who are musicians in famous rock bands from the 80s and 90s and things like that, and with the namesake of Nikola Tesla. And they were able to connect me with people who actually donated 2 5-foot-tall, musical, 1 million-volt Tesla coils.
Nice.
As far as we know, that's a world first.
That's awesome.
The only ones on planet Earth that we know of, and we put those in the planetarium, not behind glass like you'll get at the Griffith Observatory. No, we put you in the same room with nothing separating you and the lightning. There's no speakers attached, yet you hear music from the shock waves created by the lightning. So
we want
to fully immerse anyone who comes to the Wonders Center and Science Museum, which is wonderscenter.org, we want to fully immerse anybody that comes with real science, with observable, documenting history, with the physics, with archaeology, astronomy, anthropology, biology, live animals, everything you can imagine. But again, we're also going to not be ashamed to point back to God's design.
Well, that's awesome. Well, thank you so much, David, for being on our show. Thank you for your work. And guys, we want to encourage you to check it out. Go and check out the website. Go check out the museum and let us know what you think. You can send us messages and get in contact with David in the ways that he has indicated. And so that's it for our time today. And so until next time, guys, keep your conversations not left or right, but up. And we will see you when we meet again. All right. God bless.